Drink in the shoulder. All right, ladies. Up, 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 up.
This is Jason Albert, and you are listening to Nordic Nation from Faster Skier. Yep, this is episode 2 of the Pete Vordenberg Experience. And a quick reminder, explicit language is used almost right off the bat here. Okay, just a quick refresher, here's how we left off episode 1.
It sort of paints an interesting picture. Oh yeah, there's a show here. Is there a show tonight? Do you know what's going on?
Modest Yahoo.
No.
Wait, who's
are
playing?
Are you shitting me?
Wait, who are you?
Modest Yahoo.
Who are you?
Oh, I'm Zach.
From Bend?
Ish.
Bendish.
Where do you live, Zach?
In Bend. I'm here from Maryland originally.
Okay, welcome. What's your name?
Tucker. What is this thing?
It's a microphone. I know it looks kind of beastie. It's got like it's just a wind block because it's kind of windy out. Who's playing tonight?
Modest Yahoo.
Fill me in. I'm a little old.
I'm also not super versed. Okay. He's like, I believe it's like Jewish themed. He's, you know.
Originally from here.
Yeah. I think he lived here for a while, but it's like, I don't know, Mediterranean music. You might have more insight. I
mean, he's a major reggae star, man.
Dude, look at the venue here.
It's kind of.
We need to hang this shit up and go to the show.
So here's Pete to set the scene and circle us back to Modest Yahoo.
So you painted the scene at the last place. Can you paint it here, please?
You know, it's quite similar. We're on the river now. The Deschutes, also known to those just moving here from the greater LA area as the Descahoudes.
I've never heard that. That's awesome.
You got to get out.
I know. Yeah, I do need to get out. There's like the Jewish reggae star that I know nothing about.
Modest Yahoo. Yeah.
Yeah, we need to stay here tomorrow.
Have you ever seen him live?
No.
I'm assuming it's a him.
Yep, it is. This is how I found out about Modest Yahoo. Eli Brown. Do you know the name?
Yeah, so that's funny. Yeah, Eli.
Like all things on this podcast, it ties back to the Nordic ski scene. It turns out Modest Yahoo is 2 or 3 degrees separated from cross country's version of the deep state. Eli Brown is a longtime go-to wax tech for the U.S. ski team.
Anyway, Eli Brown, his brother,
yeah,
has gone through this amazing philosophical, religious, spiritual journey and landed.
Whoa.
As some sort of a, I'm not going to say he landed. He's at least passed through a spell as a, whatever you call, like a devout Jewish person.
Definitely not a rabbi.
No.
But
he's like been one of those
whirling
dervish. I don't think that he may be of the people or whatever.
Okay.
But I'm not sure that he's. You know.
Okay.
What's anyway, he's a singer. He's a singer.
Eli's brother
did this kind of singing. Eli's brother and his wife, and they.
Wow.
They performed with Modest Yahoo, so that's how I know.
Wait, what's
Modest
name?
Yahoo?
Okay, you sure you got it right?
If I can just say it as a part of a sentence, it comes out way better.
Who did Eli Brown's brother sing with?
Modest Yahoo.
Okay, perfect.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's a cool
way of
tying
it
all into it.
That's how I heard of Modest Yahoo.
So where the hell were we?
Wow.
Got it. All right. I'm going to grab
it. I then asked Pete about his thoughts on selection criteria and the whole notion of discretion.
So.
Yeah.
Faster Skier ran these articles.
Yeah.
And selection criteria and, you know, not to go into all the details.
Mm-hmm.
But people get up in arms mm-hmm. whenever the word discretion comes up.
Yeah.
And there's a portion of the selection criteria that has to do with discretion. And Chris Grover.
Yeah.
And what did you want? We were referring to him strictly as Grover, right?
There are other Grovers.
That's true. His brother lives in town. Do you know that?
Todd.
Yeah. So there's another
Great
Grover.
Dude.
Yeah, really good guy. Yeah. Really good guy. Yeah. If you guys have legal trouble, he's your man.
Yeah, that's not the Grover we're talking about.
No, we're talking about the guy, if you have ski trouble, this other guy's your man.
Grover will not wax your skis.
Chris, okay, Grover. How about like selection criteria trouble?
Look, if you are having selection criteria trouble, you put yourself in that spot.
Okay, so that's where I'm going. So this whole idea of discretion just like raises everyone's hackles, it seems like, in the U.S. ski community.
So I don't think so. I doubt that's true. I doubt you hear from
right.
the ones who have raised hackles.
You are right. I just interviewed John Caldwell earlier this week. Uh-huh. And one of the things he brought up, we had a question about, like, okay, what would you change about the selection criteria for the Olympics? He's like, more discretion. Mm-hmm.
Well, discretion is a tough point. And I got to be really clear. I'm not talking for anybody but me. I'm not speaking for Chris Grover, though I'm sure he would love it if I did. Right?
Of course.
Yeah. One thing he's always loved is when I have a couple beers and then talk for him. So I am representing Chris Grover, Matt Wickham, Brian Fish. I don't know that I... Do you know Jason Corks? Do you know Jason Corks' dad? That guy, Alden.
No, I know they grew up in like North Pole, Alaska, right?
Let me just tell you, I'm not going to mess with the Corks.
Give me a little insight into Corks' dad.
So we were.
Does that explain Cork?
I think more insight is needed to explain him.
Okay.
We're in Fairbanks. It's like it's Spring Series or whatever Spring Series has become. That takes it to places like Fairbanks rather than places like Sun Valley. Read into that what you may.
Okay.
We're in Fairbanks, and you hear from, I don't know how far away, a long way away. Sounds like NASCAR is coming this way. And this super classic, beautiful, I can't remember. I'm not a car guy, right? I just can recognize beauty. So this dude rolls. I mean, he looks like the guys that ZZ Top would hire to protect ZZ Top. He's got a beard down to here, and he's a bad dude, right?
This is Jason Cork's dad.
Cork's dad. He jumps out, also known as Mr. Cork. I don't know, maybe. So he jumps out, bearded guy. He looks like, like ZZ Top. He's, awesome. And you expect him to come up and, give you a shot of whiskey or something. He's got a tin of cookies that Mrs. Cork has baked for us. It was awesome. Huge hugs, right? He jumps out of this thing looking like he could knife you. Huge hugs all around and a big tin of cookies.
Okay, so
I love contradictions.
So we're off the Cork family cookies and back on to selection criteria. Vordenberg picks up talking about his own experience qualifying for the Olympics. Selection criteria.
Yeah. Well, so the first time, I think both times, but definitely the first time I made the Olympics, both times. The first time I made it, the second time I made it, and the third time when I didn't make it, God, I think the third time as well. I think they were just based on one event. I think it was nationals. So you'd show up there, how you did there, you're in or out. That's the worst way to pick an Olympic team.
So that would have been 96?
92, 94, and 98.
Oh, so they switched after 94.
Yes, so it was 92, 94, and then 4 years from then on.
Where was 98?
98 was in Nagano, Japan.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah. Which would have been great. I would have loved that. But he has a job to do. And he's actually quite amazing at doing this because I've witnessed him as both as a coach and as a dad for many, many years because he's had his kids are teenagers. So he was a parent during all this time that we were on the road together and working together. And when he's at work, and when he's thinking about his work stuff, he is as professional as a person can be. And he's just thinking about what he's got to do for his job and what he's got, what the goals are and how to accomplish those goals. So when he comes up with anything, first of all, he never just comes up with something by himself. It's not like he's just making something up. The selection criteria is something that has evolved and been worked on and continues to be evolved and continues to be worked on for years and years and years. And many, many people have contributed to how it's developed. There's a whole, I mean, I wish I could remember. We might have to go inside. I'm cold. I wish I could remember what it's called, but there's all kinds of committees, meetings, discussions, and these are people from all over the country, from Alaska to Maine, New Hampshire, California. They all come together and they all have a say in how these things are developed.
Yep.
So there's this whole history behind how they're developed, and there's input from all over the country. Coaches who coach college, coaches who coach high school, coaches who coach just clubs, you know, all these people, and they all have input, direct input into how these decisions are made, whether it's whatever it is. You know, what are we going to hold our junior camps?
It's inside out.
Are we going to hold our junior camps in, you know, what? How are we going to do this? How are we going to do that? And then also selection criteria. And that's how this stuff is made. And then it's decided upon through a lot of discussion and a lot of input. And with a lot of history. I mean, it didn't just come out of thin air. Grover didn't just wake up in the morning and say, "We're doing this. I don't care. We're doing this."
Okay.
There, also, Chris Grover's email, Chris Grover's phone number, Matt Whitcomb's email, Matt Whitcomb's phone number, it's all so available. If anybody has actual legitimate feedback, actual legitimate input, thoughts, ideas, they can get a hold of these guys directly and talk to them. And that's how stuff actually happens, is by talking to people. How stuff doesn't happen is by typing with your, you know, with your two index fingers as hard as you can with the caps locks key on and trying to make a comment on the internet. That doesn't achieve anything. It doesn't.
Do you think, do you think any of those guys are really going to take a call? Maybe an email.
Oh, for sure.
Yes. I mean, I don't want to mention names, but like usual suspects that comment on Pastor Skier.
Anybody who called me, of course. I don't know how many calls those guys get. Maybe times have changed. It was not the case that I got so many calls that I wasn't going to take one. And these are, in a way, these are your people. But the people that are making a difference and actually contributing to this thing are the ones that will go to the trouble to pick up the phone and make that call. And so you're going to answer the phone. Those are the people that care. If you're typing with your two fat index fingers as hard as you can, that's not caring. That's actually not that person probably isn't going to pick up the phone and call and give you a good idea about how to improve what you're going to do. All they want to do is criticize what you're trying to do. That's not a way to achieve anything. And that's not a way to help anybody. If you want to make a difference, if you really care, you will make that call, at very least. If you're too bashful to make the call, or a lot of these people, I've been in the exact same room as them, and I've seen the comments they've made, and they are too bashful, or whatever the term may be, to walk up to me and say, "Hey man, I got an idea for you. Have you considered this?" No, they wouldn't do that. And if they really cared enough, they would have done that. they're just trying to make a point to their friends or their or whatever. I don't know their motivation, but if their motivation was pure, we would have heard from them directly.
So, okay, two things. First, how are you feeling after putting on the vest?
Way better.
For real?
Honestly, yeah.
Okay.
My core temperature's come up like right. 3 degrees.
Here's my question. Sorry, it took 30 minutes. What is the hardest decision you had to make as the US ski team coach? Head coach, right? You were head coach?
Yeah. So I was the head coach starting in 2006 until 2010. As the head coach or just as a coach? The hardest decision I made and the best was quitting. I had invested, you know, however many years in the sport. My first daughter was born like in December, and I spent that winter on the road. I had been in love with the sport since, and the athletes that I was working with, and the people I was working with, even more so than the sport. The people I was working with were such a huge part of my life, and they're, you know, not everybody, but so many of them are still really good friends that I just love to see and that I cheer for every weekend and that I want, you know, I wish the best for at all times and in whatever they're doing. So to leave the sport, to make that choice, that was the hardest decision for sure.
So one of the things I remember, so again, I think I mentioned this, that I met Pete for the first time and don't forget to let me mention this hostile dog over there. I want to bring up the book again, that they were actually reading it. I told you that anecdote, right?
Who?
I told you that they were reading the book this
Who
weekend.
Who was reading it?
The skiers this weekend.
Oh yeah, yeah.
I mean, dude, that was kind of caught me off guard. Okay, so when I met you, yeah, go ahead. These are good tacos, aren't they?
We'll get more. If we need more, we'll get
some. Do you like them?
I'm hungry, yeah.
You burn a lot of calories today?
I'm skinny fat. You know what I'm saying?
What does that mean?
It means I don't have a lot of muscle because I don't do like a lot of hard exercise, but I'm constantly busy. There's never a moment of rest. Very few moments of rest, just as a parent.
I hear it. Okay.
I quit the U.S. ski team traveling more than half the year around the world.
Yeah.
And got this way harder job.
Yeah.
Way harder.
Something you chose, though.
I chose it. I look back with complete confidence that I made the right choice.
And what's that job?
Stay-at-home dad.
Yep.
It's so hard.
Yes.
Way harder. You know what's harder than being an athlete? Being a coach. You know what's harder than being a coach? I don't know. Probably a lot of things. But at least what I know about, being a stay-at-home dad. Way harder than any of that. Being an athlete's the easiest job I've ever had.
One thing that stuck with me that you said, and we were, I think the world championships had ended and you were there working on a story having to do with like sustainability and ski
Can
racing.
Can we talk about that later?
Yeah, of course. And I remember kind of turning to you and asking, so like, tell me a little bit about like your transition from elite athlete, elite level coach. You know, you're in that game, all you're thinking about 24/7 is how do I make my skis fast, my skiers faster?
Mm-hmm.
You said something like, I had to strangle the old Pete.
Yeah.
To move on.
Yeah.
Do you? I don't know. You probably don't remember saying that, but that's just something that I was like, holy crap.
I don't remember saying that, but that's totally true.
That is what you said. I had to strangle the old Pete. And the visceral image I had, I was like, wow, okay, this dude was like knee deep in this game.
Yeah. I mean, before kids, so my wife, she has her job that she's awesome at it.
What does she do?
She's a doctor, and she's great at it, and she loves it. So she's really engaged in that. So when we were just she and I, we both were engaged in our things that we were, that, you know, what she does, and as a coach, what I did is to help other people, you know, be better. Be better for her is to help them stay alive and become, you know, get back on their, get going again. And for me, it was to become, you know, as good a skier as they could possibly be, and with luck and everything else that's involved, to win at the international level. So we were both super engaged in these things, and then all of a sudden I got to shift gears from spending almost all of my waking hours, literally, I mean, and I loved it, working towards that goal. Big time breaks, and just, that's just got to go away, because now I have a new thing that I have to put all my time, energy, focus into, and that's these kids. And it, and those kids are not involved. There's no, none of my ego can play into what, to their growth. I mean, it has nothing to do with me, you know. At the, I gotta get, the more I can get out of the way, the better.
So that's, that's interesting, because that's, so one is the parent of, you know, I have a 9 and 14 year old. That's a hard thing to do.
I mean, for me, I spent 40 years chasing the Olympic dream. And that shifted from me winning that medal as the racer to somebody else winning that medal as the athlete. But still, it had so much... I didn't recognize this then, but now I can look back and say that still had so much to do with me and what I wanted to accomplish and what I, you know, felt would validate me. You know, I was validating myself through this accomplishment. And now, I mean, me? It's not even a me.
So
there tries to be. I mean, I'll tell you that.
Yeah, so how does that manifest?
It's hard. I got to take yoga, meditation. I mean, you know, you got to get, it's not easy.
All right.
So how are you doing?
Oh, good. Real good.
Oh, now he's like putting his hands.
No,
he has a vest on.
No, this is really typical for me. If it's minus 20, I can stand out on the side of the ski trail forever.
Right, if it's like 72.
If it's 72.
Forget it.
That's just how it is. No, okay. It's how it is.
Yeah. All right.
Yeah.
So,
but I want to get through what you wanted to get through first.
Well, so I guess a couple of the questions that came my way, I think you've answered, were what is Pete up to? I mean, like, very few people who are so immersed in the sport, just cold turkey.
Yeah.
Stop. They're just not immersed in the scene, whether if they're a U.S. ski team coach, they step down and maybe a regional coach, a club coach, or whatever.
Yeah.
So that's the question coming up, you know, when you've talked about what you're up to.
Yeah.
Would you know,
I want to tell you.
Yeah.
I do.
This, because you're married to an Olympic cross-country skier.
Yeah.
Would you, I mean, are your kids gonna ski? I mean, like, how does that all play out into, like, how you want to expose your kids to the sport?
Right. This is really one of the big reasons why. I mean, okay, the reasons I wanted to do this, I thought it'd be fun.
Has it been?
Awesome, man. I've loved it. Yeah, I love it. I love chatting. Some of my favorite things to do in the world involve eating, drinking, and shooting the shit.
Okay.
I love that. So, yes, what I have, the process of thought that I've gone through, I quit coaching thinking that I would come right back to it. You know, I quit. I was like, okay, I'm quitting. I'm doing the kid thing. I didn't even know what I was talking about. I had no idea. Probably nobody does. I'm doing the kid thing, and then I'll come back to coaching. And as soon as I got into being a stay-at-home dad and raising my kids, the importance of what I had been doing revealed itself. The mask was pulled off of elite level sports, and I saw that it was completely and utterly meaningless. Who wins these ski races has nothing to do with anything that makes any difference in this world. It is silliness. So that's step one. Step two, let's see, how do I explain step two? Step two, you're raising your kids, your kids get beyond the level of just needing to you know, stay alive. You're not just keeping them alive and reading them Winnie the Pooh. They don't even know what you're talking about. Now all of a sudden they're like these little things that wander around and get out, and you realize that nature, you start to realize that some of the important things that were connected with cross-country skiing. How important nature is, how important being outside all year round is, how important, you know, interacting with nature and all that is. You know, it's cross-country skiing puts you in nature in such a way that you're really interacting with it. I mean, you're dealing with the temperatures, you're dealing with the beauty of it, and also the harshness of it, and you're dealing with your own physical limits, you know, and frustrations, and trying to move about in this in nature, you know, on snow. It's not an easy thing. You're not being pulled around by your parent. You're trying to move around by yourself. And so you start to realize, okay, you know, all right, I gave up everything to do with cross-country skiing. I threw everything out, and now I realize, no, don't throw everything out. There's a lot to be gained from this activity and from this sport. And you can see your kids getting enjoyment out of it and learning from it. And I mean, I'm talking about, you know, at the age of three and stuff. All right there, you can start to see the benefit of the sport itself and doing the sport. And then I started to really reflect upon my own upbringing and what not just doing the sport did for me, but doing the sport as a competitor did for me. And, you know, the friends that it brought me, probably more than anything else, is the community that it is and how important that was. And the kind of stuff that we were up to as kids and even as adults versus what so many other people are up to, you know, on a Friday night. And I love to have some beers, and I love to, you know, carouse. But when I think about my kids, and especially when, you know, my wife is a doctor, so when I think about the kind of troubles that people are getting in out there, I really see the benefits that being a part of this sport played in my life and, you know, and can play in my kids' life. And the kind of trouble that they get in as cross-country skiers, it doesn't amount to anything compared to the kind of trouble that one can get in easily without looking too hard. There's a lot more trouble out there than what this community, you know, what we're up to. So if you're just going out cross-country skiing, that's a little different than being a competitive cross-country skier. And I haven't worked my way through this completely, you know, because there's a lot of pitfalls with competitive sport. But there's a lot more pitfalls just out there in general. And I think competitive sport really, you know, and cross-country skiing in particular can really, you know, guide you in a great direction.
Do you and your wife, I mean, I can imagine you don't, but, you know, you're sitting there, she's got the day off the next morning.
Yeah.
You're having wine, whatever. Do you guys talk, I mean, you both have these elite level experiences. Do you guys talk about that? Like,
yeah.
Oh my gosh, how are we going to raise our girls and how do we expose them?
Yeah.
I mean, that was such a huge part of like who you guys were.
Right. And I was so deep in it. I think more than Barb, more than my wife. I was so deep in it. And so focused on it, and so focused on you know, as a coach, really focused on bringing everybody along to win these races. And so when I did quit and saw kind of how empty that potentially could be, I went way in the opposite direction, where I was ready to, you know, say that this is all nonsense, this leads nowhere. And I really just started coming back within the last year, honestly, where I started to see not just the benefits of the sport, but also the benefits of being on a ski team and, you know, aiming for goals and the things that I would have, you know, talked up 1,000 times before. And we talk about it all the time, because she's super driven and super successful, basically, in everything she's done. And so I think she, for some reason, she was able to see those benefits more clearly than me. Maybe just because I swing much more, swing wildly, passionately from extreme to extreme, and she's much more of a steady person. So we talk about it all the time, and I was like, nope, we're not doing it. We're not doing any of this. Competition is out. So as I swing back, I really realize how important how the sport, you know, the coaching is and the parenting, and how you emphasize, what you emphasize is so important. So we talked earlier about like winning and what does that even mean? And it's really meaningless. Who wins a ski race? The person that wins a ski race, it's not necessarily the person that's worked the hardest. It's not necessarily the person that's worked the best, has the best technique necessarily, the person that hurts the most. I mean, it's really hard to imagine that the person that won the ski races that I were like in the Olympics, where I was like 47th. I mean, I was suffering. And not only was I suffering, but I was suffering like a sort of humiliation and a sort of like self destructive doubt in those moments, where I was hurting so bad and just watching my dreams and my hopes completely trampled and unrealistic, like in real time. Like there's this awful just realization, like, oh, I am so far away and I'm hurting so bad. I'm going as fast as I can go, and I am not gonna do it. The person that's winning the race, they may be hurting, but that's way different. I mean, I've won races. I know what it's like to win a race, and I know what it's like to lose a race. Losing a race hurts in ways that winning a race can't come close to. So, who wins a ski race? We may be learning all the wrong things by trying to imitate somebody that wins a ski race, because they're winning a ski race for reasons that they could be cheating. They could just be born with gifts that we can never overcome through the best hard work ever. But what does matter is this process of improvement and growth. So I think if we are really focused on just trying to always just improve how fast we are, how, you know, that we're learning at all times, that this sport and that competition in general has so much to teach, and, you know, just so much for a kid to enjoy, but also to really learn from and to take with them the rest of their lives. But that if you do it and it's just focused on winning, and you measure the success of the entire, like, the success of the entire operation on the outcome, then it's really self-destructive. So, can I keep going? Do you want to? Yeah. Okay, so.
I only have one more question.
Okay, so we got to tie in what I'm doing to this. So one thing I'm doing, and it's going very slowly, is I'm helping to write a book with Sten Fjeldheim. And this book, he started it like 8 years ago, and it's taken the writings and thoughts from skiers that he's coached, and all women skiers over the years. And so our idea is to put all these writings in their words into a book or some sort of a thing that that up-and-coming women athletes can read and like learn from their experiences. So many of these experiences have had troubles that I think we can, that we should be able to avoid. And most of them have to do with, a lot of them have to do with disordered eating. So I think that it's okay if you're focused on winning a race as a goal, as long as, you know, that's a goal. And the actual focus is on the process of achieving that, and that the process is right. You're going through the correct process to improve yourself, to, you know, to achieve a goal. And I know that for myself, the most enjoyable part of any of the skiing that I've ever done has been completely related to the process of doing it. Has been those times when you're out running by yourself or with your friends or whatever, and you're just completely engaged in the act of this thing. Like every pull click, that moment has your complete attention. Those are the enjoyable moments. Or as a coach, watching your athletes like go through that, and you're like that day and that workout, that's your focus. And those moments, those are the moments that you both get enjoyment from, and which, if you can focus on them, actually brings you to the next step. And I think that you start to get all these other problems when the focus just remains on the goal rather than this process of this day-to-day, moment-to-moment process of getting there. So if you really thought about winning a ski race or improving yourself as a skier, this disordered eating thing is not going to enter into that, because it doesn't get you where you want to go. So that's just one example, both of what I'm doing and kind of my process as a ex-coach, parent, and, you know, trying to think about how to approach skiing for my kids.
The last section here is about what Vordenberg was doing in Lahti at World Championships last winter with his buddy Brad Nelson. Nelson is himself a former NMU skier, a world touring drummer with the Black Eyed Snakes, and a dad.
What we were doing there, so Brad and I have this creative spark that we share. And these kids who Brad had never really fell out of love with skiing, and I did, but he helped to bring me back, and then the World Championships actually really also helped to bring me back. So we were gonna write this article for Cross Country Skiing about this sport. And it was very broad. We started out very broad, and bless their hearts down there at Cross Country Skier. Danny Cusio has put up with this. Started out very broad and wanted to talk about the community of skiing, all these aspects of skiing for this article. But what it came down to is global warming. We want to keep this sport for our kids. Right? Because all of a sudden I realized the value of this thing. And now we realize that we're losing this. We are losing it. I know you guys had a great season here in Bend, and we had a great season in Utah too. But it's not like it used to be. So we narrowed this whole thing down. We were going to talk about doping in sports. We were going to talk about what we kind of talked about, you know, like the social side of sports and the benefits and the pitfalls and stuff like that. And, you know, is cross-country skiing living or dying or whatever? And the biggest thing that this sport is facing is not doping. It's the fact that winters are getting so much shorter. And so that's what this article has come down to. But there's a huge social and community component to that. And that is that our sport is like a serious canary in the coal mine. It's our, a lot of, if you look around, all these people are just like, they're psyched, man. It's warm. It's warm. They're great. They're great.
Yeah.
They only ski once a year anyway at Christmas. They don't notice anything. But for us, we do. We have noticed that if you don't have man-made snow in the East, you don't ski. If they don't have man-made snow, that's it. They're not skiing. I mean, they're skiing for 1 week a year or whatever. Without man-made skiing in the Twin Cities, the sport is dead. It's all ultimate frisbee and mountain biking, which are great things too, but you know, it's dead without man-made skiing. So we're facing a real, I mean, we are witness to one of the first like observable effects of this, of global warming. And it's our responsibility to speak out. Not only is it our responsibility, I mean, the canary is gasping for breath at the bottom of the cage and we're looking at it. So if we don't speak out, it's gonna be too late. It's like up to us and like divers who can witness the reefs, you know, bleaching and dying. So if we are the voice of what's happening. And so if we don't speak out, then we're you know, it, for us, it's probably already, you know, we got 100 years of trying to turn this around. We got to turn it around now to save it 100 years from now. But the thing is that this is a really strong community. I mean, we're already organized into teams and into regions and clubs and stuff. And all the changes, so all the changes that are possible that can make, that can actually turn this ship around are possible because of small actions. Actions that start with one or two people and spread to a little team, and that team does something, that group, that club does something, and that spreads. It always starts with one or two people that influence their little group of people, and then that spreads, and that spreads, and that spreads. So, and this is stuff that's happening like right now. Like it, the rest of the world is taking action, and they're taking action in these kind of little small ways that you and I can do, that we as individuals and as little groups can actually have a big impact. We are the only ones that can do this. Nobody else is gonna do it. If there's one thing we're good at, it's organizing ourselves towards one goal. So set one goal and just accomplish that. Put solar on your clubhouse. Carpool to every single Wednesday practice. Hold every Tuesday practice with no driving at all. Just things like that. You come up with your own plan that you can accomplish and do it. If there's one thing cross-country skiers can do, it is be organized towards a goal. So let's do that. We are a community with so much power, with so much potential power. When I think about all of our energy put towards winning ski races, let's put some of that energy towards saving skiing. And of course, skiing is just a small thing. That's just the thing that we're into. Really, we're talking about saving a lot more than skiing. And we can do it. If nobody else can do it, we can do it. Sorry, was that too much?
No.
I got my plug in there at the end.
No, it's all good. All right, anything else?
Let me think for one, for a half a minute. Can you tie that all together, you think? Or it's going to be a task.
Yeah, no, I've got some ideas. I'm good. All right, okay. So thanks for your time.
All right. Well, no, thank you. Thanks for the beers and the good times.
Yeah, appreciate it.
Yeah.
Thanks for listening to episode 2 of the Pete Vordenberg Experience, and we'll end on this little known and most excellent piece of Vordenberg ancestry.
Where is that? What's the derivation? Vordenberg.
It's a Dutch name.
Okay.
So it means in front of the mountain. Yeah, it's a cool name, right? Vordenberg, in front of the mountain. Yeah.